Today's Always Record is another crossover with 42 Minutes. I would advise pretty strongly that you go and listen to 42 Minutes episode 191 with Zenor titled Chapel Perilous before listening to this Always Record. It's a straight-through continued conversation. Essentially, what Doug normally would have done, this is the kind of audio that Doug normally would have put into the members section as a beyond 42 minutes content exclusively for members. But as I was lucky enough to be a guest host on this show and our conversation with Zenor continued for quite a while, I spoke to Doug afterwards and I said, you know, this was such a great conversation. I really want to share it with everyone, and we on the spot made this another crossover. So you're gonna listen to 42 Minutes episode 191 and then dive in here. Thank you and enjoy.
Just like T.S. Eliot said, April is the cruelest month. His poem, The Wasteland, commemorated the death of Abraham Lincoln. Here's how it begins. April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land mixing, memory and desire stirring, dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth and forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprises coming over the Starnbergersy. Hope I said that one right. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land mixing. Memory and desire stirring dull roots with spring rain.
Thanks. That was great. That went so fast. And if you want to chat a little bit more, we'll put it in the members section as a beyond 42 minutes thing.
Sure. Yeah.
You bet. So, I mean, one of the things you mentioned, a couple things that I just want to start with. I mean, so that's something that I knew, but I guess, I mean, really stating it loudly is interesting. So that Joseph Campbell became the famed mythologist by writing a skeleton key to Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Yeah, that was his first major book.
Right, and so it's like exactly like you and Bill. So he started, it's blowing my mind right now. He started with this fictional work that apparently contains the whole universe, and he reads it and figures it out, and then goes and shows how the whole universe is connected.
Yeah. And then Star Wars comes from that.
Right. And earlier, when you're talking about, you know, facing your shadow, you can't help but think of Luke Skywalker going down into the cavern in Dagobah facing Darth
exactly.
Vader.
Right.
Of course, revealing that it's himself, which is the moment. It's like when last week, you know, Will and I kind of got into it. We sidetracked our 42 minutes and co-opted our guest's time by, you know, having this argument about the power of symbols. And I can see Will's side, you know, but at the same time, it's just so interesting that we're having this shadow battle right now so loudly.
I miss that. I haven't listened to it yet.
It's not out yet. It's not out yet.
Oh, okay. What was? Well, it might preempt.
It's okay. But so he's from the South, and you know, I'm trying to see it his way, that the Confederate flag isn't infused with, you know, overt racism to him.
Right. Yeah, I just had a similar kind of argument with a friend here just yesterday or something. The same thing, and he was I guess taking the more northern argument. Like, I'm from Canada, and I've always heard that the Civil War was about slavery, right? But I'm trying to look into it from both sides, and I'm coming across all these arguments that, saying that it was actually about states' rights, and my friend was like, no, he was adamantly against that. He's saying, no, if you look into it, it was all about slavery, right? But I don't really know. I haven't looked into it far enough, right? But definitely in terms of perception, right? There's a lot of people who see it as that, right?
As a
war for states' rights, right?
Yeah. And so if on the surface, for a majority of people, a symbol says something, you know, it's like that symbol's been co-opted, and maybe, I don't know, you let go. You just have
to. Yeah, I was sort of on a thread with Will and a whole ton of other people on Facebook talking about that whole issue, and then I was bringing up the idea of a symbol which comes from the symbolist poets in France, like sort of 1800s, like Mallarmé is one of the big ones, you know, like even going back to Baudelaire and those guys, right? And they trace their own roots back to Edgar Allan Poe, right? But their idea of a symbol is that a symbol is something that breaks you through, like it's a portal to the eternal, basically, right? So I tried to bring up in this thing that I posted, like the difference between that idea of a symbol and then the idea of a sign, which I see a flag being more like a sign. And signs themselves, they only point to other signs. Like they only have meaning in reference to other signs, right? Huh. And so if you start to argue about a sign, like which sign is acceptable and which sign is not acceptable, then that sort of legitimizes the whole system of signification, you know? So instead of taking the other side, I don't know, and trying to transform these signs into symbols, or trying to look beyond that whole system of signification entirely, right? Like just the idea, like how can you ban the Confederate flag and not ban the American flag, right? Or
yeah,
the Union.
I'm so glad to hear somebody else say that.
Or the Union Jack, you know, like the Union Jack has got to be the most bloodiest flag in history.
Is there a flag that you can picture in your mind that doesn't speak, that doesn't, at least to, maybe not to you, but that there's, I'm sure we can find, living or dead, people who view that flag as a symbol of oppression.
Yeah, like even the Canadian flag, which like American backpackers put it on their backpack just so they don't get identified as Americans, right? But even that flag, it's like Native Americans, they could associate that with cultural genocide, which is coming out now in Canada, like the extent of that, you know?
It's really interesting how Canada handles their past.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of tricky in a way, you know. It's like they put all these nice, cute animals on their money and stuff, and have a nice maple leaf flag, and it looks all cutesy and stuff. But meanwhile, there's like Canadian mining companies, for example, right? They're some of the worst corporations around. Like if you see what they've been doing in Africa and South America and other places, right?
Or in Canada.
Yeah, in Canada now.
Well, I guess I think the company even has Sink in their name, the one that's doing the tar sands project.
Yeah. For example, the uranium that was used in the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was mined in Canada, you know, in northern Canada, yeah. It's like I've had people over here, Canadians over here, saying, "Oh, we're from the peace country," you know. It's like, what are you talking about, you know?
But then, even this if brings you look us at right to Kurtz, you know, saying the horror, the heart of he's looking into the heart of darkness, and you know, what is he seeing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that comes out in the piece I was writing, based on Alan's video, about Kurtz right at the beginning of The Heart of Darkness, right as he's telling the story, and he's telling it the story on the deck of the Nelly, on which is docked on the River Thames, about to go out into the ocean. And he's saying the Heart of Darkness is right here. You know, it's right, it's in London, right? That is the Heart of Darkness. It's when the Romans came up the Thames and had to deal with the barbarians, the so-called barbarians who were living there at the time, and then settled and created London, which is, at the time of Conrad, that was the heart of the empire right there. Like that's what Washington D.C. is right now, I suppose, or something. I think it's the new Rome, you know, is London. The empire never ended.
The empire never ended.
Can I ask you guys a question? This maybe is a tangent, but Bill Klaus posted an article on Facebook that said, it was about the Charleston shooting. And it said, we need to reevaluate the way we talk about mental illness, or the way we use the phrase mental illness, or something like that, right? And it was funny because, Doug, we had just had it was the same day we had had our conversation, our member hangout, where we are talking. The conversation starts off talking to that woman who's a mental health professional. We're talking about mental health, and she's saying, oh, well, you know, mental illness isn't really the best term and all this sort of stuff. And then the conversation at some point ends up it starts there and ends on this Charleston shooting, which was basically a breaking story in that thing.
Right.
And so we have this moment where, and then I see this article that Bill dropped, which is saying, hey, to say that someone's just mentally ill ignores the racism or their fairly lucid, you know, it's not like they're just a crazy person shooting randomly into a crowd. They're shooting with prejudice. You know, they're saying, I want to shoot black people, or I want to kill Jews, or I want to whatever, right? It's not just crazy. It's an ideology that we can maybe say is crazy. Anyway, the person in the article makes a point that I think about sometimes, and she says, I'm sorry, I don't know why I said she, I think it was a guy who wrote the article, but he uses the example of the guy from Beautiful Mind. And I don't know much about this guy. Apparently he's a real person. And
you're talking about John Nash?
I guess so.
Okay. I think he just died in a car crash, but anyway, go
ahead.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. Okay. So basically saying the person from Beautiful Mind, the real life person, saying might have been a genius, but the article says that guy also believed that there was a vast global conspiracy, a vast global Jewish conspiracy, and saying, you know, we can say, hey, this person, you know, do we just say this person was crazy, or do we say, hey, he was, it's not like he said it was a global conspiracy of, you know, zebra reptiles from Neptune. He's latching on to something that many other people also believe. So this was the point, saying this wasn't like a totally quote unquote out there belief. This was a belief. This was an ideology that was shared by many, many people. So to dismiss it as mental illness ignores the fact that there are many other people out there who are blaming a global conspiracy of Jews. And I couldn't help but read that and think of something that I never really hear get mentioned, which is we talk about Philip K. Dick as a sort of modern day prophet, but even his sort of, you know, answer that he comes to is that, you know, there's these Kabbalistic magicians who are withholding the return of Jesus Christ because they're a bunch of dirty Jews. You know, like, is the modern day prophet also just as guilty of inherent anti-Semitism as anyone else, you know?
Yeah, that gets into huge things, right? Like, it's almost like I'm thinking of Ezra Pound too, and that's that's what he got to.
Yeah, that's exactly where he landed.
But he but edited. I mean, in your piece, you say that T.S. Eliot had he had like hope in there, and then Ezra Pound edited like the hope out. Like there was no chance of redemption in Ezra Pound's wasteland.
Yeah, that's true. What he did with the wasteland, but maybe you shouldn't have come across like that. Like Pound himself, like if you read the cantos, yeah, he's full of hope. Like his whole idea is that the cantos, in a way, is an updating of Dante's Divine Comedy, right? But for Pound, it's almost like those three states, the inferno and purgatory and paradise, are all happening at once at the same time, right? And Pound wants that vision of paradise. Like that's his whole thing, is he wants that vision of paradise. But I think he was really sensitive of the timing of the thing, right? And so that's he with the wastelands, he wanted to explore, with Eliot, he wanted to explore that moment before the coming of Christ, like before final redemption again, right? But then if you get into Eliot's later stuff, that's what he talks to, like the four quartets especially, right? So I don't think that Pound was trying to hold that back necessarily. He was just trying, I don't know, he sensed this period in history, right, where we had to explore a certain moment and then move beyond that moment, right? And I think he realized with Eliot, like you can't just say it was all Pound, of course, but he realized with Eliot that to deeply explore that moment that the wasteland encapsulates would be so powerful, and it was, you know. There's nothing that that dense, really, or that precise, that captures that unique moment, you know. So I don't know. I think with Pound, though, he got into looking at, he talks about two conspiracies basically, and one is sort of this benign conspiracy to sort of a conspiracy of an intelligence, right, or a conspiracy of the imagination. And he traced that right back to the Eleusinian mysteries. And he saw that as being this sort of undercurrent throughout history, like going through the troubadours and Dante and into the Renaissance and so on, into the Romantics. I don't know. I think he also saw at the same time the second conspiracy is a conspiracy against that, which is this conspiracy of usura, of usury, right? And it's almost as if the Jews are designed to be the scapegoat of that, right? Like even if you look at the history of the Jews, they were denied property for most of the Middle Ages, so they had to get into money lending, right? It's almost like they were put into that role, and then since that time they're used as a sort of default scapegoat, right? And so anytime you look deeply into the conspiracy, eventually it leads into the Jews again, right? And this is what's happening at Red Ice, you know. But I think that's a false stop, you know, and that's the point that Ezra Pound, to his credit, I think he realized that towards the end, right? That he realized he was wrong with that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely, I see what you're saying. It's funny because you guys have hit on these things that I was thinking about while I was at work. So tonight I did I work at a restaurant, but it's in a hotel, and sometimes we do like catering events, like, you know, like a banquet hall, and I'll do that as well. So tonight, instead of working in the restaurant, I worked in this banquet hall, and this is Virginia. It's a pretty much black and white area. Like, you don't have a lot of mixed minorities. It's like a lot of white people and a lot of black people. most of the banquets that we do are for Black events. So I've been doing, like, I've done a ton of Prince Hall Mason banquets, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And a ton of Black church functions, which is, again, you know, it's just sort of interesting in this, the Charleston thing, right? But what I notice, there's a few things that have really come up to me. Like being in the room, it's sort of like being a fly on the wall. As a banquet, you know, waiter, you're kind of invisible, you know, while people are just doing their thing. This is like if someone showed up at our sink summit to just, you know, pour us some drinks for us, and we, you know, didn't really talk to them, and they just watched what we did, how we whatever, right? And there's a few things that have come up for me. And one is the idea that almost in this sort of Red Ice, like the validity of one point that the Red Ice type of crowd will make is that I don't think there's been a single one of these events that I've gone to where people, the people there haven't said essentially about the importance of Black families, like a Black father and a Black mother making Black babies.
Hmm.
All right. Whereas, again, if someone were to hear a white person say that, like, well, I look at, you know, the Red Ice crowd going, we need more white babies. And I'm like, what are you, fucking crazy? But, you know, this idea that, like, other races are saying, hey, we want to preserve our race, that it doesn't have that same knee-jerk, visceral, something's wrong here feeling about it, right? Is a fascinating, it's a genuinely fascinating point to me. But you know, whether or not we can argue all the subtleties of it, I'm just saying it's actually a fascinating area of potential debate. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that hearing this, even in all these sort of otherwise non-spiritual gatherings, there, you know, today's event was a high school reunion, you know, there'll be a, I don't know, you know, someone's birthday party, it'll be whatever. There's not a single one of them doesn't have a moment of singing some sort of hymn of praise to Jesus or God or whatever, or they'll have a pastor get up and give a little sermon. There's not a single one that's lacking that. And as I was leaving work, as I was leaving this function tonight, towards the end, I heard this one man say to someone else, he said, God is great. God is great. And immediately my mind jumped to the sort of hipsterism of the modern take on Gnosticism. And Doug, you brought up the Demiurge right away, in the sense that, like, if you look at the people who historically have had it pretty fucking shitty, the Blacks and the Jews, they've managed to with to hold on to their praise of actually this God is on their side. Whereas it's a bunch of young, essentially privileged white guys who are like, God is a dickhead and he's out to destroy us all.
Why can't he just right. let me get a real job? Come right. on, God, what is...
And
God is not
really,
good.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, it's again, it's just an opposite. I don't really have a horse in the race. I'm not trying to make a, you know, I'm not really not trying to make a point. It's just to say it was this fascinating thing where I was really, it just made me think, like, one could argue it's a Stockholm syndrome or it's just a, like I said, just the idea that through it all, you have a races of people that are still seeing the hope of the paradise as Pound and Dante and so on, this idea of, like, even in the wasteland there's hope. And then we have a bunch of people who maybe don't even have it that bad. They have a bunch of first world problems and are going, God is terrible and has put me in this black iron prison. I'm in the Matrix and I need to fucking get out.
But are we seeing the personal or the universal? Like, sometimes when I'm having a discussion with someone, it's hard. Like, I think you and I think sometimes similarly, Alan, where some people are okay in a completely broken system to like paint the wall. You know, like if you're in this toxic space, and so long as, you know, you've made progress. And it's like, no, we have to tear the building down and then put the waste in some kind of treatment facility that keeps it away from people for 10,000 years. Painting the wall is not going to help, but we might live in a world where all you can do is paint the wall. Like, Obama was on the WTF podcast, and this is all part of the weirdness that I'm talking about. Just this, like, on the 26th, it seems like, so the president's singing Amazing Grace, and he's making black people feel good, and he's making white liberals feel good, and, you know, everyone is just, all of a sudden there's this switch that got flipped, and it doesn't feel like the world's going to end all of a sudden.
If you're a black or white liberal, because obviously for the conservatives, you know, the white conservatives,
they just had their teeth
the opposite.
Kicked in. Right.
And again, I'm not one of them, but I'm just saying, let's be very clear here. For a segment of the population, it's the opposite.
But he said that all you can. So he's driving the Death Star, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he is not. I mean, basically, he's saying that, look, the Death Star doesn't turn very well. You can't go 50 degrees any direction. You can go 2 degrees. And those 2 degrees will get you someplace in the future closer to where you want to be than where you want to be now. So, like, hey, you know, I put a broken system in place, but that's all we can do. You know, you can't start over. All you can do is, you know, take something broken and hope that the broken thing that you attach to it.
So we need to have Buckminster Fuller for president.
he could turn it the whole way.
Yeah, he could turn it the whole way. His thing was right. You can't, you know, there's no way to repair a broken system. You need a completely different system. And Doug, I understand your question, right? Is that possible? I have no idea.
Slavoj Zizek said something. I can never find it, but he said something like out of the ashes of the collapsed system, the phoenix will rise. Like, and that kind of moves into that realm you were talking about, ALP, where a self-organizing system will rise from the ashes, or it's the star card.
But isn't it's also the basic theory.
Sirius is up there, and it's going to give us hope.
but you realize that is the same, that same vision is the nightmare scenario for everyone fearing an Illuminati, New World Order, like the order out of chaos, right?
Exactly.
They are trying to destroy this great thing we had going on, you know, whatever they think was so great. And they're trying to destroy it so that they can take over out of, you know, the order out of chaos. So I'm just saying there's other people looking at that same vision and seeing it as a nightmare.
Well, it's not even like, it doesn't, if you look into it, it's, you don't have to find it as being star craving mad or paranoid. Like, there's some very articulate people who are talking about like the influence of cultural Marxism on white society and how it's designed to break down the family and sort of, you know what I mean. It's take the power away from the whites. You know, it's like,
what if the family is a not a good structure?
Well, obviously it's not. You know?
It's like, so what, like, those are the things I'm talking about. So like our idea of separateness, you know, like, you know, our little nuclear families, like, you know,
the argument goes, right, if you look into really deep kind of conspiracy theorists like Alan Watts, you know, Alan Watt.
Yeah.
But he's about the deepest guy out there, right? And he's not really racist. He doesn't come across as that at all. He's not saying the Jews are behind everything, but he's saying it's like this massive program where what happens is originally you broke down the tribe, right? And the tribe was the basic unit of human freedom, right? That's where we could be free, right? And so that's broken down. and then eventually you maybe have clans, like bigger clans, and then that's broken down, and then you have extended families, and then that's broken down, and eventually you have the nuclear family, and then finally that's broken down, and it's just atomized individuals, right, who even their own psyche is fractured, and that makes them so much easier to control. And at that stage you have either a Brave New World scenario or a 1984 scenario or a bit of both, you know. And so for them, the nuclear family, as limited as it is, it's the last sort of thing to be broken down before it's just you and the state, you know, and that's it.
I get what you mean. Like I said, you know, when I sort of see that the strength that comes from a lot of communities of, if we could say, racial, ethnic communities, again, whether it be blacks, Jews, anything, there is a strength that comes from a sense of community and like an almost collectivism in the sense of like, we're all in this together.
A shared identity.
Exactly.
But so Joseph Campbell was, you know, he was articulating basically the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
We need a shared identity. Like, we need to come together as a people of the earth. And so he was using the blue marble moment. From the moon, earth from the moon. This is who we are. We're one thing. We're all humans together.
See, I don't know if that is the New World Order. Like, I think that's the New World Order maybe tries to capture that myth, you know, but it's not really that, right? It's
so sort like of, the idea of no states.
The New World Order, I think, is an Antichrist simulacra of that, you know.
That's just it. When you say no states, I think when people talk New World Order, they're envisioning a global state.
But whereas an anarchist is going to say society needs institutions, because institutions are bigger than a person, say, right? But institutions are scary because they can have so much momentum that all of a sudden, you know, they take the agency from an individual because you have this megalithic institution.
Would have institutions regardless, right? Like there's Sinkbook Press, right? Like there's bottom up institutions that will form. Like Kropotkin, he talked about in his time, like you can take, this was back in the 1880s or something. You could take a train from Paris to Moscow, and at that time there was no national train lines. It was just a bunch of privately owned train lines, and a whole bunch of them. But you could get a ticket from Paris to Moscow and have it lined up so that you could catch a train all the way across, and it would line up perfectly, and you could arrive in Moscow basically at the time you wanted, right? And he saw that as being an example of institutions, but self-organizing without central control, right?
Okay.
Without the state, right? And so.
But then I look at my city and I see the beautiful medians, you know, and you're in this world that's being. That there is this background state that is taking care of like the aesthetic feel of orderliness.
But way before the state, you had the commons, right? And that I would say that I wasn't there, obviously, but it sounds a lot more beautiful than our public parks these days, you know. I don't know. I just don't see the necessity of it.
I'm tainted by this idea of enterprise, that the world needs to be exploited. Or that there's less world to exploit now, and so the idea of the savior of the commons would be the state at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what Zizek thinks, right? Like he thinks that the problems that we face now are so great that we need a sort of, he doesn't say a world state or anything, but it definitely a governmental action, like an international governmental action to fight things like global warming or all these other problems that we face in the world, that there's no way to really fix those problems without that sort of centralized authority. But I don't know. I totally reject that model. I think the way to do it is just give people freedom, right? Give people freedom to run their lives and not have to work as wage slaves in meaningless jobs that that are just producing shit that goes to waste anyways, right? Like if you did that, then people would self-organize into something that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Do you think of yourself, so like, I don't know that, I mean, so we have to be in that system, right? Like that's...
Mm, yeah.
I mean, so when we had Martin Adams on a couple weeks ago, it was nice for him to say, you know, don't feel guilty for the system. You didn't make this. The system's way bigger than you. All you can do is be in the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's musical chairs. There aren't enough chairs. This is how it is.
It's recognizing the water you're swimming in.
Right.
I mean, ideologically aligned with Zenor, but and Doug, actually, I would say fairly opposed to what you're saying. But I also recognize that, say, Zenor and I have had many conversations. He moved to Japan. Like, the process, the paperwork, and essentially submission to another form of government. It's mm-hmm. In a fantasy, I think, I want to escape the American bureaucracy and power system here, but it's just transferring over to another wing of it. It's certainly not an escape from it. And it comes with its own baggage and its own set of rules. And, Zenor has said to me, he said, Japan is not a good place for an anarchist. So my question for you, Zenor, would be, how do you, you know, just like, you know, how do you sleep at night, but yeah, how do you cope with that sort of reality of the water you swim in being so starkly opposed to how you'd like to see it?
Yeah, actually, I'm sleeping less and less at night. No, I don't. You just have to make space, like make your own creative space. That's the only way. And it is a matter of changing your perception. More importantly, right? Like being able to. I'm gonna write about McLuhan soon. I'm in the process of it, but he's talking about how perception itself is the incarnation, right? Your every moment of perception is you're basically turning chaos into order and back again, flipping back again, like second by second by second, right? And this is what's happening with Christ, like the Word becoming flesh constantly, right? To have that sort of perception, that's when you gain that moment of what Blake also was talking about, like seeing the sun as this the hallelujah chorus of angels, you know? Like it's really looking at the world through the imagination. And of course, it's so hard to do, and I'm not saying that I do it even like even a fraction of the time. I'm trying to do this, you know. I'm trying to do this, but that's the only way. I think that's the if there's a way out, the way out is through our perception. Right?
I'm here in Virginia, I am surrounded by military bases. Like, you can't go a few miles in any direction and there's a fucking military base. It's ridiculous. The next exit down the highway for me is NASA Langley. on my way to work, I pass, I don't even know what it's called, but it's a huge fucking naval base, right? And I have to take this tunnel to work. So I go under this water, and then I come out, and there's these huge fucking battleships, and there's all these helicopters swarming overhead every day, and these crazy flying machines. Like, I've seen these, like, essentially with, like, giant drones of, like, helicopters with, like, four blades, and I don't know, like, all these crazy things. And I can't help but look at it and, you know, at the same time feel this mixture of, like, absolute disgust at, like, this is what we put these resources, because this is, like, let me tell you something. I am blown away at how kind of wastelandish America is. Like, I don't know. Like, everyone's fucking broke. And being in Virginia, like, there is total shit. There is nothing here. I'm sorry to be so hard on it. There's, like, nothing good here. And
well, you're there, Alan.
what I'm saying, though, is, like, in like I'm saying, so people are fucking broke. It's a very, like, industrial wasteland. But then I see, like, these things that have money. We have I had a friend who worked at NASA. She said they burn, like, they have these jets fly overhead. You'll hear some just these crazy, like, jets rumbling your windows. They do this to burn up fuel, because if they don't use enough fuel, their budget decreases. So if they can justify that they're using all this fuel, then they'll actually increase their budget for the next month. So that's why at the end of every month, you know, like, in a lot of places, like, cops write a lot of tickets at the end of the month. Here, at the end of the month, you have jets flying overhead because they're burning up fuel to justify their fuel costs. So, like, there's all these things that are disgusting. But there was every now and then, I am driving, and someone's like, it's a beautiful day. And I look out, and I'm driving through this huge tunnel under the water while giant fucking battleships are sailing above my head. And these crazy flying machines are above me. And I think, even though it's so perverse, there's something special about, like, this human ingenuity that, like, I'm witnessing the potential of human intellect. It's just such a shame that it's being used in this way. But, like,
right.
These engineering feats, I'm like, able on some occasions to, like, appreciate them as going, man, we could be fucking amazing if we really tried.
Yeah. Just that whole moment even is incredible, right? Like, this whole moment right now, what we're doing right now is incredible, right? Like, talking, you guys are where almost like a one side of a continent away from each other, right? And then I'm on the other side of an ocean, right? And we're having a live conversation over this, you know. It's like it's incredible when you think of it. Like, it, and every moment is like that. It is incredible. And but even if there was no technology, just like going off into the woods and seeing what happens there is amazing, right? But usually we don't see it, you know. Like, usually, yeah, we're not aware of it. It's
Oh, beautifully said. It's something about, you know, sort of appreciating, you know, this is, I guess, Doug, this is what you mean by the painting the walls of the Black Iron Prison? Is this, you know?
Nice color. Right.
Rainbow walls now.
Yeah. Oh, so can I tell you guys just one more thing? So, again, another sink that Doug asked, because Doug only asked me to do this a few hours ago. I was, like, on my way to work, and we were talking, and he's like, I'm talking to Znort tonight. I was like, oh, man, I've been thinking about him all fucking week and wondering how you're doing and wanting to talk to you and all this sort of stuff. Here's a little funny thing. You started off with this Lancelot thing. Are either of you familiar with T.H. White, like Once and Future King?
Oh, yeah, and that's part of my sink, is that I'm listening to this book called H's for Hawk, and she built her whole book off of T.H. White.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't really know it. Yeah.
But he's gay, and back then these gay men would kind of project they would project onto animals when they couldn't talk about their real interior lives. And he wrote this book about him trying to train this goshawk, which is, you know, according to this woman, not good hawkery. I don't know, falconry. It's like it's everything you could do wrong, he did wrong. And then he wrote about it. But it's a beautiful book because you know that he's also writing about his, you know, he's writing about himself.
Absolutely.
He's projecting his interior life, which was, there was no outlet for it, and so he had to project it onto this animal.
Well, so
his self-hatred came out and manifested in this goshawk.
Well, so just how, like, Mallory's Mort d'Arthur is like a celebration of murder. T.H. White is taking the Arthurian stories and doing the opposite. He's telling the story of Arthurian legend as a staunchly anti-war, he's trying. So if you've ever seen like Disney's Sword and Stone.
Yeah.
It's kind of based on this, where it's Merlin training young Arthur. But the idea is that T.H. White is showing Arthur, basically, you have to learn how to live in harmony with nature. And like, so he's trying to teach him all these different things, and in a sense, getting his philosophy out there, which is, again, it's particularly anti-war, trying to show all the horrors of war. And throughout it, Merlin keeps showing Arthur, like, war is fucked up. But anyway, so now I'm living in Virginia, and I'm having to engage with nature, which, of course, I'm thinking, I love nature. But you know what? There's things of nature that suck. Like, the other day, a fucking hornet's nest outside my front door, and I'm like, deal with this? You know,
That's a sink. We got one right, buzzing right beside me right now, actually.
So, and then like, all these ants invaded my front door over the last week. I keep getting this ant invasion, and I was thinking about this thing that T.H. White wrote, where he turns, so if you've seen Disney's Sword in the Stone, he turns Arthur into these different animals, but even though in Disney's version it's just seen as this sort of like kind of goofy, you know, like little things, there was a point. So Doug, you're saying like with the hawk, he's trying to show that you can learn something from every aspect of nature. So at one point he turns Arthur into an ant to experience ant consciousness or whatever, right? And basically, T.H. White probably didn't like ants as much as I do right now, because it's pretty scathing, you know, details of ant life. But they have so I was going to actually make – I haven't been on Facebook in forever, but I was thinking about this. I was going to go on Facebook and change my Facebook profile to this picture from T.H. White's book, which is this ant colony that has these giant signs. It's like a Brave New World 1984 world, and the ants have these giant signs that say, "Everything not forbidden is compulsory." And then under it says, "By new order." The new order is like this is the mandate of the new order. So but it says, "Everything not forbidden is compulsory." And this phrase was sort of like fascinating to me, and just like it's been playing my head, and I was gonna make this my Facebook thing, and then I go on Facebook and everyone's got this fucking rainbow they just changed the law to be gay, you know, that did you have gay marriage. and I was afraid that it would be interpreted now if I put this up it would be like, you know, that it was I like it was this funny sync of like I was going to put up this thing and everyone's changing their Facebook profiles like, yay, gay marriage is legal now. And I would have put up this thing that said everything not forbidden is compulsory.
That would have been perfect.
People would have thought I was a real asshole.
Oh, they know, Alan.
Yeah, that's funny what you said about the ants, too. Like, I sometimes feel like that in Tokyo, like going to work in the morning, like really early in the morning, like getting on the train around 6:15 or whatever. And the trains are packed in the morning, like rush hour traffic on the train. And usually people are, it's just all business people, right? Usually men, and they're all in their black suits, and they're all going, we're going through these tunnels to get to the train, these big platforms, and through these tunnels and down the stairs and to these under tunnels and onto the train. And you hardly see daylight at all going up to Tokyo. And it's like, it's exactly like this ant hive, you know, it's like this big ant colony, you know, everybody in their black suit going, scurrying through in this mass, you know. Yeah, it's really interesting, actually.
When you mentioned ants, Alan, it made me think of back to my idea of like institution and the state. And so if you April was in Nepal, and I may have said this before, if you've ever seen like a intersection in Nepal or some other place, there is definitely an order there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's organic.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone gets where they're going because everyone knows what the custom is, I guess. It's like when you get someplace that doesn't know what they're doing, that's when it screws up and it doesn't function.
You were saying like there's no traffic lights, no...
There's nothing. No, it's helmet. Just chaos. It's crazy.
yeah, it is.
Kids on motorbikes without helmets, but the guy riding the motorbike has a helmet because there's a law that the guy on the motorbike has to have a helmet, but the 13 kids on the back don't. And they're all coming to this intersection and going through in cars, and they just it flows, right? No one dies. Yeah. It looks like everyone should die all the time. And there's this German part of me. You know, the Germans, they want, like, precise order. Right? You come and, you know, you come to the – and the, every, you know there's – the state has the authority to tell you what the rules are, and it's communicated through the technology and the infrastructure that this is – you know. But then there was something on NPR recently about ants and how – ants are able to move a lot more mass in a shorter amount of time than we ever could because they don't have any attachment to what they're doing. They just are in their little ant moment.
Mm.
You know, so like you were talking about being in the ants and stuff, but because, you know, and they're okay with bumping into each other too. But they can get a lot of ants from one place to another because, you know, they all, you know, I guess they're all after the same thing. There isn't any one ant that, you know, is like, I'm in a hurry. I got to get through this mess of ants.
Yeah, I'm just reading, I just finished reading Thomas Pynchon, The Crying of Lot 49.
Oh, interesting. You read? I haven't
That's
read
That's an amazing book, yeah. Alex Fulton, sort of, he read it and then he urged me to read it and we've been sort of talking about it together. But there's a point in there where one of the characters is talking about an anarchist miracle, right? And that later gets illustrated by the main character, this woman, after being up all night and having this whole. Like this whole sink storm happened to her in the streets and back alleys of San Francisco. She ends up going into this hotel, and in the lobby of the hotel, there's this ball, like a dance ball of these deaf and mute people, like a big convention, right? And they're all dancing, and they're all in having partners, and she gets grabbed by some really handsome deaf guy. And they're all dancing, but they can't hear any music, of course. So they're all dancing to whatever beat they want. Like each couple has their own beat, their own steps. And she's like, "Wow, fuck! It's everybody's gonna collide. When is this gonna happen? You know, when is everything gonna smash into each other?" And it never happens, right? It never happens. It's the same as like the traffic in Nepal or India, you know.
And that's the anarchist miracle.
That's the anarchist miracle, right? Like the
I wonder if that's right. So then I have this paradigm, this mental idea that I'm, I think you even mentioned it in your synchronized thing, the idea of perspective in art and how that's become the thing, you know, the God perspective. And so I'm sitting up above the world, you know, putting my judgment of concern over the lives of everyone around me, you know, like, oh, you're going too fast. Oh, you're going to kill a bunch of kids. You need to slow down. You know, that kind of...
Mm-hmm. The overseer point of view, like the kind of...
The overlook. I'm the overlook.
The Archimedean fixed center or something, right? Like,
What a fixed point perspective that makes the viewer God.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas before that, we weren't tied into that. You could see multiple perspectives simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Then if you look, you go further back with the cave paintings in France and Spain, and it's just like overlay of animals in every single, like, the really kind of realistic portrayals of them, like really sort of artistic, but just the perspective is all, they're all on top of each other. They're all overlaid on top of each other at different angles and different horizons. And but it just shows that kind of single pointed perspective wasn't there. You know, they thought completely differently.
I think Picasso ends up, I bet you he's a similar time as Joyce, in a similar place.
Yeah, for sure. He was living in Paris at the same time.
Because I think he's doing the same thing with perspective.
Yeah, and he was directly influenced by those cave paintings. Like they were just being discovered at that time. That whole sort of primitivist movement or cubism that comes in with Picasso was deeply influenced by that, and African art as well, which is getting more display, you know. Well. But it's interesting what you said. Like, it's kind of, again, it's perspective or our ability to change perspective. And even beyond that, like perception, like our means of even looking at things changes, right? Yeah.
Well, so it's... What time is it? Is it 3:30 in Japan?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, PM.
Yeah. The next day.
Well, it's the next day.
I started in...
Yeah, when you started this off and you're saying it's the 27th, it was already the 28th for both me and Zenora.
There's only one real place.
Yeah, that was your single fixed perspective
it
there,
really
mister.
Yeah. So you're 12:25 after midnight.
Yeah.
On the 28th. Yeah, June 28th is interesting because it's 6:28, which is the number of pages in the wake. Right?
Oh,
so
that's great. Yeah. I was listening to episode 44 of Always Record mostly tonight, and I mean, it seems like you guys got into some really interesting stuff. The wake, now I'm inspired to consider attacking it. I did. Ulysses was one of those books that I thought, I need to read this. And so I must have been like 19 or 20, and I really fought about a third of the way through that. And I didn't have a clue what the hell was going on at all.
Yeah, you need guides, and you need to just press on. Like, you just continue. Try to read a bit of it every day, and then with Finnegan's Wake now, there's this whole new. I don't know if you guys came across this whole new audio project with a bunch of artists and musicians from around the world who they each tackled one chapter of the Wake, and it's all online. You can listen to it all now. Some of that's really interesting. So you could read the Wake and then listen to those guys speak at the same time, which is a great way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, so like that's I do take in a lot of books. I have a lot of kids, and so I take audiobooks as a way of. But I was thinking with that book, it seems like there are some things that are composed both, you know, to hear, but then also to see. And I wonder if you lose if you he's creating purposeful puns, you know, you won't be able to see, you know, the wordplay, and you might lose a level of nuance from that.
Yeah. I wouldn't. Well, you could, but I would want to do both, like listen and read it at the same time. Yeah.
You can get an abridged version of it for 1 hour.
Oh yeah. That's a.
I wonder how do you turn the wake into an hour.
Yeah, I guess you could turn it into anything.
Okay, well.
You guys are it's getting late for you guys. What time is it for you, Alan? It must be
2:27 a.m. It's pi a.m.
Okay.
It was. Now it's 2:28.
My computer still says 2:27, motherfucker. And I have to go do a 2-hour drive now, so.
You do?
Yeah.
Where are you going? What are you doing?
In your fucking business.
Dude.
No, I'm. my wife and I have one car. I have to go to work tomorrow. My wife has to be somewhere near her parents' house, so. I won't be able to do it tomorrow. You know, basically, I don't need the car to go to work tomorrow. So I'm going to drive her out to her parents' house tonight.
Will you stay out there? Or?
It would probably be a mistake to, even though I'd want to, because traffic. See, like, people, there's so much crazy traffic here. Like, it's summertime. People go to Virginia Beach, right? So, like... Mm. Everything kind of can change drastically, traffic-wise. So, like, this ride, which I said right now will take me about 40 minutes each way, could take me hours and hours if I wait till tomorrow to do it. So, I think I'm going to do it tonight.
Gotcha.
Here's a long
question
night.
For you before we take off. So you, I know that you are academic, and you enjoy doing research and writing and stuff. Do you ever see yourself doing anything? I mean, so it's interesting because I respect the actual art form of the literary sync blog. Like, there's something there that it's unique to sync blogging. Like, it's own thing, but as far as a respected form goes, it doesn't have enough time to actually be considered anything more than just our little subculture thing.
Yeah.
Do you ever see yourself playing with more traditional forms?
Like a book or something,
like
you mean?
Like a book or, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be great. I have sort of an idea in mind, but it's just a matter of time, you know. But the blog, I don't know. The blog itself is a good challenge, right? Like it's a good way to get stuff out, you know. But yeah, I know what you're saying. Like it's sort of academic, but it's not academic. Like it wouldn't be academically acceptable at all what I'm doing. You know? It's too whacked out, you know. It's like, it's hard to know. Yeah, it's hard to know what to do with it. Bill suggested I should get, for now, just take a bunch of posts or essays and then try to put it together as a book or something, and try to get it out that way, like just a book of essays or something. But I don't know if that would work.
Bill and I actually have had this conversation that I said I've never wanted to say this to you out loud because I know you're still trying to figure out what you want to do and what, you know, how you want to do it, and I don't really want to influence, but to me, it's actually a no-brainer. Like, there's a lot of, you know, say, like, we mentioned before, we were comparing you to Jason Barrera. You know, there's type of blogging where it really would be impossible to, it has to be on a blog. Jason Barrera has to be in a mixed media format because he's using GIFs and video clips and whatever. Where you, what you're doing are essentially essays. Now, obviously, they're augmented by photos, but even a lot of the images that you're using very often are
public domain.
Public domain images. You could actually still keep many of them, but even if you there was something that you couldn't, it's not really essential. And I'm sure, you know, I don't mean that to trivialize your choice of images.
No, yeah, I know what you mean. So
to say, to me, it is a no-brainer. Like, your writing is so good. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. It is so fucking good.
Yeah,
and, you know, I think it's funny. We discussed Synchronize, and Doug and I think it was Doug. I think we were just talking this the other day, I was talking to Guillaume the other day, saying Synchronize as a podcast was an interesting thing because I found, like, I can listen to an interview or an Always Record while I'm doing dishes or while I'm driving or whatever. But Synchronize, I found it very hard to listen to while doing something else. It's an audio essay. So basically, if I missed 12 seconds of it, I could be lost. I had to actively pay attention, which is great. But I find that blogs are the same kind of thing. It's like the podcast where we are tempted to scan anything digital.
Especially I wonder what's going to happen towards the bottom. And so you just start flipping your fingers on the new mouse pads to see some of the images toward the bottom.
And it's something I have such a hard time convincing anybody of this, except for the few people that I've worked with where we've actually done books, is that we'll go over, like, someone will write it in, like, say, Microsoft Word, right? They're going to write a book, and they send me this file. And then me and Jason Barrera has actually helped me edit many of these books, right? So I'll look it over, and I'll find a bunch of things that I think, okay, we want to clean up how this is written and whatever. And Jason Barrera, his thing is, like, he's all about, like, grammar and punctuation. So Jason Barrera will look it over, and he'll send me a list of fucking – I found these 200 grammatical things or whatever. And so we're kind of like, it's a process of cleaning it. And I'm telling you, man, we will read over these things dozens of times. You know, you just take a book and you just read it, and you read to the end, and then you start back at the beginning. You read it again, and you start back at the beginning. And we'll email each other and be like, hey, I found these 100 things. And he'll be like, I found these 100 things. And then we'll go over this for a while, over, you know, a period of months. And then I will order a book proof. And we say something. Once I have a physical thing in my hand, I tell you, it is such a different experience that every sentence reads differently. It feels, its medium is the message, right? Every sentence is different now. And I'm noticing instantly, I'm noticing on a page 5 things that we missed. I was like, how did we fucking miss this? We thought the whole thing was clean. We've gone over it a million times. But it's the level of attention and importance that we give a printed word that we don't give a digital word. It's a bizarre psychological medium is the message thing. And I feel like, you know, I don't know that you would ever, and I'll say, but let me be very clear, I don't think you could sell many fucking copies.
I wouldn't expect.
But I just feel like what you write deserves to be read with the attention it deserves. And
that's interesting.
So take that as you. Like I said, no one's buying books.
They're not. And then they're definitely not interested in, like, a Synchronicity magazine. But every now and again, I think, what if we did that? What, instead of putting them into, like, a quarterly?
I love that idea.
Synchronicity essays. You want to put one in the fall issue? All right. But you know how much work that would be, Alan? That would be like doing a sync book 4 times a year, kind of.
I know.
It sounds fun, yeah. though, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Like, I don't like reading stuff myself online. You know, I print it off if I find something really interesting. Yeah. So I always wonder about that, and I'm impressed if I get comments where people who've obviously read it all the way through. You know. So yeah, it's kind of I know what you're saying. It's kind of like a huge effort in futility almost, or something. I don't know, but that. I should consider that. I don't know why everybody wouldn't do that though. Like with blogs, like if they, I suppose they could, right?
I don't know. It was that.
I
moment.
Was saying not everyone could,
it's
particularly.
Accessibility
though. Right. The blog. Why? Yeah. It was instant feedback. It was readers. You know, there was something immediate about doing a sync blog, even writing it, where I got to get this out. I got to get this out.
Yeah.
And then instead of like taking the time, I would publish. You know, it's like, okay, it's out there. And then I'd read it again. It's like, oh, lots of mistakes, huh? Then you edit, and then you read it again a couple days later, and you're like, huh, wow, still mistakes, huh? And then, but like the idea of crafting too. So, you know, that's interesting to me, where a sync blog for me really was really like this kind of almost vomiting, where there was so much connection that I just had to get it out now.
But yeah. Then, yeah. Sometimes you don't want to miss the moment either. Right.
But then as far as like a poem where you're working, or like, you know, the idea of spending 17 years on a book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you're just tightening and tweaking and making it perfect.
Yeah.
Not writing a page a day. Or like a page a month, or a page every 2 months. Like, this is my writing schedule right now.
Yeah.
A page a day would be great.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I would consider doing something like that. I should maybe think about that over the summertime and think if there's any possibility of doing that.
If one's blog happened to all of a sudden communicate this through line, so that the posts were, you know, like serialized, like it seems like back in the Victorian time, that's how a lot of writers would do it. So they were getting paid because they're selling it to the newspaper. They're writing a serial. And maybe they have some idea where this book is going to go, but you know, the immediacy was that this chapter would go in the newspaper.
Well, even Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, they were both serialized at the beginning, chapter after chapter.
There's nothing
new.
That's
right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
can you imagine living in a time like, as I'm saying, no one's appreciating. I shouldn't say no one's appreciating, but I don't know. How do you like the idea of a serial anything anymore?
The idea that we've gone to TV, that is all, the entire thing is all there. Like, this is the new thing, where before, your show comes on at this time, in this place, and then you watch it. And then next week, if you come back to the same time in the same place, you can watch the next one. And now, you get everything in a dump. And then if you like it, you can come back in a year and get another dump.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was the same thing. I remember I grew up. Me and my brother collected comic books, and you'd get one issue a month, and you'd have to wait for the next month. And something happened, which actually like drastically altered the industry at some point, was they started issuing what they called trade paperbacks, and they would take, you know, 12 issues, lump them together, and sell them as basically with the advent of people buying graphic novels. I'm like, well, we kind of have this stuff. Let's stick them together and make like a graphic novel. And people were stopped buying the cereals and just started buying the trades. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, well, do we still print these singles anymore? You know, and it's almost, and now we see that's happening with TV, yeah, where people can buy it, you know, buy a DVD or on.
It's Netflix.
Netflix, whatever it is.
Netflix,
yeah.
Produces their shows and they release all the episodes all at one time.
I was listening to Neil Kramer, who was on Jason Horsley's podcast.
That was an interesting one, huh?
No, wasn't it? Especially the end of that was funny. But he said something in there which was interesting. He was talking about making money, and he said the thing that's working out for him the best now is recording his essays, making an audio file, and then selling a file for just like a few dollars or whatever it is, yeah. He was saying that that's making a lot more money than any book that he's ever produced has ever made, you know. So that's an interesting kind of model for people to consider, I guess, as well.
Yeah, but I think we're doing something kind of similar or not, but yeah, I did hear him say that.
Synchronize is closer to that, when you're actually reading copy,
like
an essay as opposed to a conversation.
But all this stuff is interesting because it's like you read Ezra Pound and he's thinking about the exact same questions, right? And he was like this. He was like the Alan Green of the modernist movement, you know. He was in contact with all the different artists and writers and stuff, and getting them all together and organized, right? And like way before, he was into fascism, of course, right? But
that's my next step.
He was thinking the same thing. It's like, how can we make money for these guys? Like, how can you make it into a sustainable lifestyle where you can actually have artists have the time to put out their art, you know?
Did you guys listen to John's guest KMO?
No, I want to, but no.
I haven't heard it yet.
That was a pretty good one. It was interesting, and he was talking about how what we're witnessing, like, you can't necessarily perceive it in your lifetime, but over the course of a few generations, you see that this is civilization in collapse. Mm-hmm. And I will entertain thoughts if people say them with enough authority, right? It's like, oh yeah, this guy totally knows what he's talking about. But it was a pretty interesting thought, you know, to say, you know, here's somebody at this point in time goes to high school and then gets a good job and, you know, has a wife and supports the kids, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, some more time passes and now you have to go to college and you have to have two incomes. And then, and you know, it's now, you know, you're at the point where to support kids, you have to get divorced and you have four incomes, right? And so I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. I don't know. It's like, art is one of those tricky things, especially
I just hope my wife marries a really rich guy. So, maybe he'll even support Sing Book Press.
Yeah, need a patron somewhere.
That's actually the thing, like the angel patron with the oil monies. Right,
like Donald Trump.
Manly P. Hall had somebody that supported him. I would love someone to say, "I want to fund some sync research for a couple years." It's like, okay.
Thomas Pynchon, at the age of 51, he got this MacArthur grant that gives them their age times $1,000 a year. So he got $51,000 a year for 5 years, and that was renewable for I don't know how long he renewed it for, but like imagine that, like getting like $51,000 a year from to write something, right?
Yeah.
But that's Thomas Pynchon. You know? Yeah. None of us are Thomas Pynchon. We're even approaching that.
Yeah,
how do you get to be? I think, I mean, like, that's the thing. It's,
yeah.
Philip K. Dick wrote a lot.
On speed.
That's how he wrote a lot.
So maybe I should just think Book Press should invest in tons of methamphetamines. For...
Well, that's how you get money, and in another way from dealing meth is.
We could sell the meth, and then we give some to our authors so they can write a lot.
All right.
Yeah, I should really call it. Guys,
well, it was nice meeting you, Zanor. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was great to meet you. Too bad that Will wasn't around, but hopefully I get to talk to him again another time.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, and oftentimes when I'm meeting someone, it's a taste. And then I'll get an itching, and then we'll have an excuse to. With 42 minutes, since it's weekly, I'm really nailed down to like real specific topics that I'm looking into from week to week.
You guys are like the evolution of 42 minutes is amazing. You know, like, you guys are like totally professional now. It's like you could be an NPR show, I think.
I agree.
I'm amazed by it now.
It takes a lot of will and focus to stay on the weekly schedule, but it's so much fun. But it means that, like, when that moment is done, it is totally done. There's no looking back. And so, like, it really is communicating this kind of, like, now philosophy where it's like, all right, I have this moment to enjoy this, because when it's done, it's done.
Right, like, it's on to the next episode.
I can't, right. And then if I don't get in deep enough, then, you know, I'm not prepared for the next episode.
Basically what Doug's saying is, as soon as he hangs up, he's going to forget that he ever spoke to us tonight.
No, but then it gives me an excuse to... So what I'm saying is that I'd like to have an excuse to revisit something, but as far as, like what Doug does for fun, Doug does 42 minutes for fun. You know what I mean? So, like, I need good excuses to... So, like... I'm kind of doing this whole moon. I'd like to have excuses to take things on. I'm going to read or listen to Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow in July.
Oh, yeah, that's a great. I just did it this year as well. Yeah. Well, I read it, but yeah, amazing. Amazing stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, that's interesting, particularly in light of. All the rainbow stuff.
Oh,
the
last, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really interesting. All right. Guys, such an amazing pleasure. Thank you so much. I should really run. Have a great night, okay?
Yeah, you too. Have a safe drive.
Thanks. Be well, boys.
You going to drink a Red Bull?
I've been drinking coffee while I talk to you.
Okay. All right, you drive safe, Alan.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, Zanor. You take care.
Yeah, see you there. See you. Okay. Wait.
We're the hollow men. We're the stuffed men, leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices when we whisper together are quiet and meaningless as wind and dry grass. A rat's feet.
Oh, he's out there.
Glass in our dry cellar.
He's really out there.
Shape without form. Shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion.
Do you know what the man's saying? Do you?
Those are the thoughts.
Out here in the fields, I fight for my meals. I get my back into I don't need to be forgiven. Yeah, yeah.
morning, this afternoon, however you want to think about it.
Good. How you doing?
I'm okay. I decided to add a co-host to help us out tonight.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
I am so happy to be speaking to you, man.
Yeah, right on. Get to talk to you again, man.
Okay, so I do have an introduction, as per the normal 42 minutes.
Do you have anything you need me to read, or you're good?
I'm good. We'll see how it goes. I am recording. I have my clock ready. I haven't done this for a while. It's 94 in Boise, 57 in Winnipeg, 67 in Asheville. We got rain in New York.
What's it like in Tokyo?
I don't know.
Well, I'm just south of Tokyo, and it's cloudy and but nice, hot. Really hot.
Oh yeah? Fahrenheit or centigrade? Is it Celsius?
Celsius here, yeah. I don't know what it is. I think it's over 30 or something.
Do you think in that? Oh, you're from Canada. I just spent a couple hours with you and always record, so I I know details about your life that you divulged in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, I know you through this, 42 minutes, but usually you don't give much of a background about yourself on this show either, right? So I ended up hearing you on Pentimental, which was excellent.
Great.
Yeah, so I get a bit more background on you as well, which is interesting.
Felt really a lot in that. I think my hands were moving all over the place.
Yeah, it's probably going to happen to me today.
But yeah, it was fun. Cool.
It's nice to do interviews in like a friendly setting. So it's like, of course, it's still like the nerves are there, but at least it's still a friendly and somewhat familiar environment, nonetheless.
Yeah, 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 for sure. So Will is where is he? He's in Texas or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Will.
Yeah, he's at a wedding.
So I was gonna say no. He's from Denver. I misunderstood completely. So Will actually is in Texas
tonight.
Oh, wow. Okay, I did not know that. I mean, not like I have a GPS up Will Morgan's ass or something. I just meant,
sure.
Like, I thought you were saying, like, oh, okay, you know, is that where Will is from?
Where is he from? He's from the South somewhere, right?
Well, he's from somewhere in the South, like Alabama, I think, but he lives in Denver.
Yeah. I think I knew that, but yeah. Nice place.
I've had the pleasure of visiting both these guys a few times, and I really like both of those spaces. Denver and Boise are surprisingly cool places to visit.
Yeah, you had an epic road trip, right? You went pretty well everywhere.
Yeah, I kind of did. I think it hit me at the end of the trip when I realized that we had gotten an oil change, I think, 6 times before the trip was over. And that gave me a sense of how much ground we covered.
I guess the only person you missed was Mark LeClaire in Calgary.
I mean, there's plenty of people that I missed. I mean, for sure. But I would love to. You know, my trip over the border into Canada was a very short, like, we crammed that visit in. But, you know, to go to Winnipeg and even just spend a few hours with Jake was really, you know, I didn't realize how important it was to me until I was there. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, like, he was a very real person, like mm-hmm. our... you know, I think of him as someone who's inspired this movement a lot, but also someone who, because he inspired a movement, I sometimes butt heads with his seeming ideology.
Right.
So I sort of, he's, you know, both, you know, plays both those roles in my mind. But to actually spend time with him and be like, oh, he's just actually a cool dude that's kind of dorky and into movies and very easy to get along with, normal person, was a pleasure, because it took it just felt like it just grounded the whole, you know, the whole way I think of it a lot more.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's something, maybe that's a new thing, right? We can see beyond people's ideologies and go straight to the source and see who they are.
So much of what we do online is a manufactured personality, right? So if you're on Facebook, particularly if you're someone like a Jake, you're not Jake online. You are synchromistic.
He was the Blob.
Yeah, you know.
You have your avatar.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, we are avatars. We are completely manufactured. Even if we try not to be,
it's not so much as anymore. But because since I was selling this yesterday at this, I pitched the idea of a Sync Summit to a big music festival yesterday.
Oh, great!
And I was trying to explain how early on, when we were just finding each other, it was kind of like, it was almost like superheroes, where we had these secret identities, and that was part of the fun. But that was the early internet, where you got to recreate yourself. A digital version of yourself, kind of.
Yeah, a mask. Yeah, I still like that idea. I like like Yeats talks all about that, the necessity of the mask, and the mask is almost like your anti-self in a way. It's all the things that you can't really be on your own. So yeah, I like to wear that mask as well.
I mean, you're wearing it right now.
You know? Yeah, for sure.
Which I'm totally cool with. I mean, idea that you can actually stay Zorro. Like, your ego is good with being just Zorro. Like, that's cool, because I know that I was always peeking out. Like, I was all, I mean, I had so many masks.
It's cool because I'm not even Zorro, right?
No, I know. I know, Znor. I know.
You just created a new mask for me. That's cool. When do we record?
We record right now. Here we go. You ready?
Ah, okay.
Of course. Right. The baby was so nice and quiet, and then I was getting all set up. You guys were chatting. All right. So, here we go. I'm going to count backwards, and then I'm going to read the intro and... All right, you ready? So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.